It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Dear Colgate, I love that you love that I love being at home. You even let me whiten my teeth from home. Because you know how I feel about getting up from my cloud couch. The Colgate Optic White LED Kit gives professional level results in just 10 minutes a day for 10 days when used as directed. And that's why, Colgate, I want you to meet my parents. Because ever since meeting you, I've been living life to the brightest. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
I'm mad at you, pretty baby, don't be mad at me.
Jazz legend Sarah Vaughan sang and scatted with the best of bebop's golden age. She made music with giants. Earl Hines, Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, Count Basie. Audiences adored her. She scored big hits through the 50s, became a true symphonic diva in the twilight of her career with sweeping numbers featuring lush orchestrations. She was an icon for women's and civil rights during the turbulent Jim Crow era. This hour on Point, the life and music of sassy Sarah Vaughan. You can join us online or on air. Have you discovered for yourself the music of the Divine One? Which songs speak to you? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Seattle, Washington is Elaine Hayes, an author and jazz historian. She's out with a new biography called Queen of Bebop: The Musical Lives of Sarah Vaughan. You can read an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. Elaine Hayes, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
You know, as I was reading the book, I was reminded of how any biographer has to really, over a long time, live with their subject. have them like a roommate, and maybe even love them a little bit in a way. How did you get involved with Sarah Vaughan?
Yeah, it's one of those things that happened a little bit later in life for me. Growing up as a kid, I was a classical pianist and violist, and I didn't listen to much jazz until college, thanks to a roommate of mine, and she played a lot of Sarah Vaughan. And I immediately was just struck by her amazing voice. And as I listened more, I became more and more impressed with how she used her voice, the big swoops and how she would scat, and her vibrato, and how she would infuse her songs with this beautiful tension, this harmonic tension. So I just kept on listening more and more. And one of the things that struck me about her, aside from the incredible musicianship, was that when she performed, she had this amazing presence. I heard a woman who was strong and confident, a master of her craft, control of her situation. And as a young woman myself, just finding my way in the world, these were qualities that I really valued. So I kept on listening. And then a couple years later, I had an opportunity as a graduate student to research her further. And the project that is coming out now is basically a product of that.
You know, when you look back at some of the era that Sarah Vaughan was making her name in, there were a lot of great women singers. Dinah Washington, Ella Fitzgerald, Rosemary Clooney, later Shirley Bassey, Dakota Staton, Doris Day. I mean, a lot of different genres and styles in there, but there were a lot of great women singers. What was it about Sarah Vaughan that made her stand out? What made her different from, I don't know, any of these others that you might name?
That's an excellent question, because all the vocalists you list really are truly phenomenal. I think one of the things that was unique about Sarah is when she was coming up in the mid-40s, she was singing in a way that really hadn't been heard before. Early on, she was associated with a lot of the beboppers, and they were developing a new way to think and conceive about music. And when she came on the scene, it was just this breath of fresh air that no one had heard before. And it kind of went from there.
Yeah, it was interesting. As someone who's worked my whole life in media of one kind or another, this book has to bring the reader back to a time when big media was really gathering steam. You have to teach your reader a lot about national radio, the power of networks, columnists, reviewers, producers, the music scene, how records get made, the influence of a Mitch Miller, of a Dave Garraway in the 1950s, when the person, it's hard to think of who the Mitch Miller of 2017 is, who the Dave Garraway of 2017 is, who the Norman Grants of 2017 is. The world was so different in 1952.
Yes, it really was. And that's one of the things I enjoy about this kind of project is going back and imagining what it was like at that time. And like you say, it was very different.
Let's listen to Body and Soul from Sarah Vaughan. She recorded this in 1946. This was the song she happened to be singing when she won Amateur Night at the Apollo, also the launching pad for Ella Fitzgerald. Elaine Hayes, the rules were different, I think, then. I mean, Sarah Vaughan could sing Body and Soul, fully aware that many others had sung it. Many others had even had some success with it, but that didn't shut the door to any vocalist trying their hand at something.
Yes, that's very true. Back then, many vocalists would cover the same song, and each would try to put their own unique stamp on it. And that is clearly what Sarah Vaughan did here. Thinking back to her Apollo appearance back in 1942, when she decided that she was going to venture up to New York City from Newark, New Jersey, and try her hand at this famed amateur night, you need to think a little bit about what she was actually trying to do. At that time, the Apollo Theater was the center of black entertainment, definitely in New York. The audiences were ruckus and very boisterous. They would throw things down on stage. They would boo and hiss a person off stage if they didn't like the way they were performing. And in 1942, when Vaughan first started singing this song and gained some national recognition, she was still a very young woman. She was only 18, and she looked so much younger. And like you say, Body and Soul was already a hugely popular tune. Billie Holiday had a very popular rendition. So when she decided to sing a tune like this, she was really taking a big risk. But when she sang it at the Apollo night, and she really nailed it. She sang with poise and confidence. She sang in a way that was completely her own, and the audiences were captivated by her.
And yes, you mentioned how famously raucous they could be, and they could basically hoot you off stage. But if you brought the goods, you could quiet the room and have them eating out of your hand, right?
Yes, and that's precisely what she did. In fact, that night when she was in the amateur show, vocalist Billy Eckstein, who happened to be working with Earl Hines Band at that time, was in the crowd, and he was simply floored by what he'd heard. He had not expected to hear anything like that night. And he went ahead and recommended that Sarah, his boss, Earl Hines, take a listen to Sarah. And Hines did, gave her an audition, and then went on to decide to hire her for his band. And that's basically how her career started. She got her big break at the Apollo night, amateur night.
And as you mentioned, as a kid, let's remember just how
yeah,
young.
She's very young.
A teenager standing in front of that crowd up in Harlem. But Sarah Vaughan's roots, both as a musician and as an American human being living in the 20th century, were in the church. Let's listen to her recording briefly of the Lord's Prayer. Elaine Hayes, you could do Body and Soul, you could do naughty and even slightly risque jazz numbers, and you could sing the Lord's Prayer and nobody would say, hey, you can't do that. Music was different then.
Well, actually, when she released this tune in 1947, it was a little bit controversial. It wasn't typical for an artist who had previously been recording in pop and jazz to also decide to release a spiritual or a sacred piece of music. And she started incorporating it into her live acts. And a DJ asked her, well, why do you sing this song? And she said, well, I love to pray. I love to sing. And this way I can do both at the same time. But by her insisting on singing pop, also incorporating the sacred music, she was actually being a bit of a revolutionary there, asserting her musical independence and a refusal to be labeled or pigeonholed.
We're going to have to talk about that a lot more in the balance of the program, because that's a theme you come to again and again, that Sarah Vaughan insisted on making her own way.
Oh, yes. She famously said, and said it often, that she hated musical labels. She thought it was just, it was good music or it was bad music. And she was coming from a generation of musicians who really understand the power of labels and how they could shape audience expectations, how producers use them to create audience expectations, and how to put a performer into a niche. And she didn't want anything to do with that. She wanted to have the freedom to sing her way and not be constrained of ideas about race or gender.
We're discussing the life and career of singer Sarah Vaughan. Author and music historian Elaine Hayes is out with a big new biography of the jazz legend, Queen of Bebop. You can join the conversation. Did you ever see Sarah Vaughan perform live? Do you know her from her work with some of the biggest names in 20th century American music? What about her pop hits in the 1950s? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And we'll go out with Don't Blame Me, off Sarah Vaughan's live album One Night Stand, the Town Hall concert. We'll talk more about Sarah's live performances right after the break. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. I'm talking with Elaine Hayes, an author and jazz historian in Seattle, who's just written a new, definitive biography of jazz legend Sarah Vaughan. Right now, we're hearing the song I Cover the Waterfront from her 1947 live album One Night Stand. You can join the conversation. What are your favorite tracks from Sarah Vaughan? Do you prefer her classic jazz repertoire or the more traditional pop standards from the 1950s? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's go first to Bridgewater, Massachusetts. Faye is calling. Welcome to On Point.
Well, hi, how are you, Ray? And how nice to have an opportunity to just comment upon my experience of seeing Sarah Vaughan in 1953, in person at the Hi Hat on Mass Avenue in Boston. This was a wonderful, actually it was a little fire trap when you think about it, but the best artists were there, and I mean, I saw Errol Garner, Billy Mitchell Quartet, but the night that Sarah came, she was so exquisite. I can still see her in that satin gown, and as I was saying, with that satin voice, she was elegant, and her voice just flowed over you. It was just exquisite. And you know, we've lost this. We've lost this melodic quality. Today it seems so many female vocalists just scream. They're so strident in their delivery. And I mean, we've lost the beauty, the emotional, soothing, emotional quality of a voice like hers. And at that time, too, everybody was unique, truly unique. They had a distinctive quality. Billie Holiday was Billie Holiday. Dinah Washington was Dinah Washington. And Sarah Vaughan was certainly Sarah Vaughan, the divine one. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Faye. Elaine Hayes?
That's a lovely memory, and I feel like it brings so many wonderful issues about Sarah Vaughan. One of them being that you're talking about how emotional her singing was and how she was able to emotionally resonate with her audiences. She was really able to tap into human experiences, and regardless of your race or gender or background, kind of communicate to you these very deep, profound emotions. And I feel like that is one of the things that's so powerful about her singing. And that is why it resonates with so many different people.
I'm glad she mentioned the hi-hat, because this was one of the great golden ages of clubs in Chicago, in New York, and in places like Boston and St. Louis and so on. There were night spots where the music would go on well into the next morning, and you could see literally the greatest American musicians of their time for a couple of bucks.
Yeah, it's not like that anymore, unfortunately.
The hi-hat, the Blue Note, Birdland, the Five Spot, 52nd Street in Manhattan, just amazing places that were legends and places where legends were made. It's stunning that you didn't make a better living, though. I guess I guess there's a relationship between that couple of bucks that it cost the audience and the facts that you weren't making a great living. But for a time there, certainly from the pages of your book, Queen of Bebop, Sarah Vaughan was not making a load of dough.
You know, in the early years, she was definitely struggling a little bit and kind of building up her reputation. But by the mid-50s, when she's got a national reputation and she's starting to have an international reputation, she's actually doing really quite well for herself. And in part, that has to do with some of her great pop successes from those eras. She had, in the early 50s, become very adept at appealing to a jazz crowd, but also at the same time being accessible for new pop audiences. And she had some pretty reasonable record deals.
Our caller, Faye, talked about how these women all were unmistakably themselves and really originals. But did artists have a lot of negotiating power? She was selling a lot of records and later on certainly doing quite well. But it also sounded, certainly in the early days with her first label, Musicraft, that she didn't have a strong hand to play at the negotiating table.
Not necessarily. Yeah, not really. One of the challenges that Sarah had throughout her entire career was kind of tensions with the record producers. They wanted her to do one thing and she might want to do something else. And so this is a tension that played out throughout her entire career. And at times we hear her kind of pushing back a little bit, and other times she acquiesces and does pop material that she later comes to regret. But over the course of her career, we see her getting I would say stronger or more assertive in basically saying, well, I don't want to record that. She became much more discriminating in how she chose her material. And by the end of her career, she's making a lot of her own choices and producing her own albums.
We'll take a listen to Make Yourself Comfortable, which, just as you mentioned, is a trendy novelty song. It was very successful for her, but one that she maybe didn't even really want to sing.
I've got some records here to put you in the mood. The
phone is off the hook, so no one can intrude. I feel romantic and the record changes automatic, baby. Sweetheart.
You tell the story in Queen of Bebop about her having to record a lot of these kinds of songs, certainly when she was under the administration of Mitch Miller at Columbia. He had a very, very specific set of ideas about what she should be singing, and she really didn't have any choice, it sounded like.
Yeah, oftentimes she didn't have a choice. With this particular song, Make Yourself Comfortable, I've heard stories about her. She's in the studio, Bob Shad presents this to her, and she says, you know, I don't want to do it. Because it's not really, in the sense of a musically interesting song, something that she could really get her teeth in musically. It's a pretty simple, straightforward little tune. But her husband and manager at the time basically said, Sassy, we have a contract. You got to sing it. So she did. And I think, you know, we listen to this song now, and it sounds really dated. Like, it's kind of cheesy, it's kind of campy, and it could be easy to dismiss it as something that she's saying, you know, oh, wow, that was an unfortunate commercial excursion she had to do there. But I do think that songs like this really do capture the ethos of the post-war America. They can tell us so much about tastes and what people expected to hear and what they wanted to hear. And like you said, a tune like this, which is so novelty, was a huge hit for her.
800-423-8255. Highland Park, Michigan is next. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Thanks. I had a couple of experiences with Sarah Vaughan. Once as a child, when I was about 5, in Idlewild, Michigan, which was a resort town that black entertainers used to go to, we were taking a walk one day, and we ran into Sarah Vaughan. She knew my dad from having worked with him at the Flame Show Bar in Detroit. And for some reason that morning, we went out and my hair wasn't combed. So she was fussing at my dad for bringing me out with my hair not combed. And we saw her perform at the Paradise Club that night because children were allowed to go to the Sunday matinees. Then again in Toronto, when I was in my 40s, she was booked with the symphony orchestra at one of the outdoor concerts. However, they didn't promote her. They just promoted the orchestra. So she didn't have the audience that she otherwise would have. And they presented her with a big bouquet of flowers, which she in turn gave to me and my friend, because we were going to go see her longtime friend, Abby Lincoln, at another club in Toronto that time. Both times she was a really special person. Awesome performances.
That seems so strange that they wouldn't have promoted the fact that they had her along, just the orchestra. What does that tell us about the stage of her career, Elaine Hayes?
I'm not sure if it tells us that much about her stage of her career. Sometimes venues just didn't do a very good job promoting her gigs, and there's a limited amount that she could do about that. By the time she was performing with symphony orchestras, that was probably in the mid-70s or into the 80s. And actually, at that point, she had weathered some really difficult years in the late 60s and 70s. By the time she started playing with symphony orchestras, her career was actually in a recovery mode, and she was actually doing quite well. So I'm not quite sure why she wasn't promoted as well as she should have been. Hopefully the audiences enjoyed her and they learned something new. They heard a new voice that perhaps they hadn't heard before.
Mark writes, hope they mention her great Who Listens to Radio promos. What does he mean by that? Was she someone who was trying to keep radio alive as a music space when it was waning?
You know, I have to confess, I'm not quite sure. I think during the 40s and the 50s, DJs loved her. And then they played her music all the time. That's kind of the era of the DJ. But like I was saying, into the 60s and 70s, jazz is having a really hard time on radio because of the emergence of rock and roll. So in that sense, jazz on radio is becoming less and less prominent.
There has never perhaps been a more astonishing singer, writes one of our online posters. Seemingly effortless musicality in every note. Looking forward to this program. Well, we're glad we can bring it to you. We should talk a little bit about race and the role it played both in the early days when Sarah Vaughan was touring with some of the great jazz combos of the time through a still segregated South, and also the role it played when promoting and marketing musicians later in her career in the 1950s and 60s. It sounded like touring through clubs in the South in the late 40s and early 50s was a pretty harrowing experience.
Yeah, black musicians were going, especially when they were accustomed being in the North, going down South. They were experiencing the full force of Jim Crow. And Sarah Vaughan, and when she was with the Billy Eckstine band and the Earl Hines band, encountered some really unfortunate, kind of scary situations. One that comes to mind is the Eckstine band was playing an outside venue, and the Ku Klux Klan shows up, and they're in their robes, and they have shotguns that they're shooting into the air. And the band runs to their bus, and as they are driving out of town on Main Street, the Ku Klux Klan is actually lined up along Main Street and is shooting at the bus as they're leaving. And the only way the band kind of survives this is by getting down on the floor. But there were also other more subtle forms of racism. Sarah Vaughan would often say that, you know, at least they're honest in the South. They don't like color people and Jews. But in the North, you know, that's just one of the worst places ever. And I feel like another story that kind of demonstrates that is a couple of years later in 1948, her career is it's on the rise. She's been crowned the Divine One by the DJ Dave Garraway. And she's gotten a gig at the Fairmont Hotel in Philadelphia. And her name is on the marquee, the Divine Sarah Vaughan singing this week. And she walks into the hotel carrying her suitcase, goes up to the front desk and says, "Hi, you know, I'm Sarah Vaughan." And they say, "Oh, great. We're so glad you're here. We're really looking forward to your performances this week. Here's the bellboy. He'll show you where you're going to sleep." So the bellboy takes her bag and proceeds to walk downstairs to the basement of the hotel, through the bowels of the hotel. They're passing the kitchen and the laundry room and then they make their way back to a locker room with an army cot in the middle. And the bellboy says, "Oh, that's for you." And she turns to him and looks at him and pauses and says, "Follow me." And she walks, retraces her steps, walks back upstairs, out the front door of the Fairmont, across the street to the hotel across the street, and books herself into the penthouse and confessed that basically she spent all the money she earned at the Fairmont in order to be able to stay at the penthouse, but she was determined that she was not going to be treated with disrespect.
There were attempts also to force her, shoehorn her, you might even say, into singing various black styles, vernacular styles, or pigeonholing her in that way and saying, "You should sing this because you're a black American."
Yeah, this was especially the case early on in her career. There's a story where she talks about in 1946, she's, you know, just started out as a solo act. She's kind of struggling. And a very influential producer named John Hammond says, "Hey, you know, I'll make you the next Bessie Smith." And she didn't want to be, you know, a blues singer. And she says, no, I don't want to do that. And he was angry about it. But she later said that, you know, lots of people think that because I'm black, I should sing the blues. And this made her angry. She understood that there were a lot of kind of connotations that came with the blues. It was often viewed as the music of the South, more rural, more primitive, intuitive way of performing, and that this is how black people sounded. This is what they should sing. But early on and throughout her entire career, she wanted to create a different kind of music. She wanted to create a music that was her own, but also a music that was intellectual and very sophisticated and harmonically, rhythmically, just a different kind of music that didn't fit into those stereotypes. She wanted to create another way to hear what a black female voice could sound like.
And she didn't want to be Ma Rainey. She wanted to be Sarah Vaughan.
Yeah, she wanted to be herself. And that's one of the themes that runs throughout her entire career, that she's often has these external forces pressing up against her, be it a record producer, sometimes a husband or manager, or even a club owner saying, "We want you to do this." And she pushes back and she says, "No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be myself."
We're discussing the life, legacy, and music of jazz legend Sarah Vaughan. Our guest Elaine Hayes is out with a new biography of the singer known as Sassy. You can join the conversation. What do you make of Sarah Vaughan's music? Do her soaring vocals draw you in, captivate you? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll go out with Sarah Vaughan's biggest hit, Broken-Hearted Melody. Audiences requested it for years, but she hated it. And after that, she became pickier about the material she chose to record. This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with author and music historian Elaine Hayes about her new biography of the Queen of Bebop, The Musical Lives of Sarah Vaughan. This is the first studio recording of another one of her biggest hits, Send in the Clowns. You can join the conversation. Did you discover Sarah Vaughan long after her death? Does her music still resonate with you? Why? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can join us or follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our next stop this hour is Green, Maine, where Lou is standing by. Lou, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Elaine. Thank you, Ray. I'll let other people describe the magnificence of this woman's voice, which still thrills me. I'd just like to describe her persona on stage. I had the opportunity of seeing her in one of her final concerts, an outdoor concert in New Hampshire, and she filled the entire arena. But the most magical moment that I think is a good insight into her personality is when she first came out, she was wearing this huge tent of a gown with gigantic flowers on it. And the audience was so stunned because she looked absolutely magnificently beautiful. And she went to the microphone and she said, "Yes, now I look like Lena Horne, but by the end of this concert, I'm going to look like Sarah Vaughan," because she perspired so profusely. But the evening was absolutely magical. I'll never forget it. And she still thrills me with her music.
Lou, thanks a lot for sharing that memory. And I'm glad you told that story, because what Sarah Vaughan looks like comes up again and again in your story, Elaine Hayes. And why is that so critical?
Well, when she began her career, she was a very young woman. And like many young performers, she needed to work on kind of updating and glamorizing her look. And this was a pretty normal process. But, and especially as she was getting on bigger record labels, she needed to become a little bit more mainstream looking and kind of hip and glamorous. One of the reasons why Sarah Vaughan's looks are so central to the way we often tell our story is that in the early 1950s, her first husband basically created this elaborate marketing campaign called Sarah Vaughan and Her Pygmalion, where her husband was the Svengali who basically was in charge of creating this woman that we see today. You know, he made her over from an ugly duckling into a beautiful swan. So this idea of, you know, she used to be ugly and now she was pretty is, I think in a large part a marketing campaign, but it does point to some issues where Sarah Vaughan maybe wasn't always as secure about how she looked. And the comments about, I coming on stage and I look like Lena Horne and I come off looking like Sarah Vaughan. First of all, it makes me sad when I hear that, but it points to what some of the very high beauty standards there were for women performers during this age.
You know, it is also, I think it speaks to the difficulties that black women trying to go mainstream may have faced when it came to their hair, when it came to whether you were dark-skinned or light-skinned.
Mm-hmm.
It's complicated for any woman singer. And just recently I was talking with Linda Ronstadt about this very thing, who I think, you know, probably a lot of people think of as kind of a glamour puss, obviously beautiful woman, but how much emphasis there was from the label, from the promoters, from the people who made the record covers, the jackets for albums, to emphasize physical beauty. It's aesthetics may change over time, and I was trying not to look at these pictures, and the book, incidentally, has a great many wonderful pictures. I was trying not to be a 2017 man looking at this, but there's some early photos where she's quite young, and the line of her jaw and her head is thrown back where she's hitting a note, and it's a beautiful photo, and I thought, at the same time, there were probably a lot of Americans who just wouldn't think of this person as a beautiful person.
Yeah, so when I look at those pictures, too, I think she's adorable, but also she is a striking beauty. But we need to remember that then, perhaps more so than now, really the standard of beauty was kind of blonde, blue-eyed, thin woman. And as a black woman, it's, you know, you just can't achieve that. So there really was a lot of emphasis on, like I said, streamlining this look and kind of trying telling a story that made it seem that she was more normalized, that, oh, yeah, she kind of fits into these mainstream standards of
beauty.
But
it's interesting that talent doesn't trump that necessarily. It can. I mean, Ella Fitzgerald, who struggled with her weight all her life, who in her early career was rejected by some band leaders because they wanted someone pretty out in mm-hmm. front of the band, ends up being one of the great American musicians of the 20th century, but it wasn't easy.
Yeah, you didn't have to be a glamorous beauty in order to succeed, but there was an enormous amount of pressure to be a certain kind of beautiful.
Elaine Hayes, author and music historian, the author of The Musical Lives of Sarah Vaughan, is with us. Our next stop, Valrico, Florida, where Bob is standing by. Bob, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. How you doing? I just wanted to say you're talking to an 85-year-old white guy that was first introduced to Sarah Vaughan when I was in the military in Korea. Some disc jockey, in his wisdom, started playing her tunes, and we fell in love with her. We didn't care whether she was black, green, or yellow, or whatever. She was an entertainer. She had a velvet voice. She knew how to sing. And I don't believe this story about she had such a hard time. Nobody looked at her as color. They looked at her as an entertainer, and she was a magician. And we all fell in love with her, and I loved her to this day. I listen to her music, and they don't come any better. Thank you, Ray.
Thanks a lot for your call, Bob. It's such a great gift to, in the course of this hour, get so many calls from people who saw a woman who's been dead for some time now
as
a live act. It's really terrific. Let's go next to Miami, Florida. Ray joins us now. Ray, welcome to the program.
Well, Ray, hello. This is Ray to Ray. so much has been said about Sarah's, the way she looked. And my wife and I, both in the music business, were very anxious to hear a singer that nobody had heard of. And Dave Garraway was really big on radio, kept talking about this fantastic singer. So we were fortunate enough to be in Chicago. And out comes, he came out and introduced her. And out comes this skinny, scared, young girl in a sweater. I'm not kidding. And she got out, and we, my wife was a singer, so we were curious about, you know, what's so great. Well, she opened her mouth, and inside of minutes, it was absolutely phenomenal to hear a voice like that. Now, I'm talking probably it was 1946, I would say 46 or 47, probably 46.
And, I'm thinking it's probably 1947. Dave Garraway sponsored a number of concerts in Chicago featuring her in 47.
Okay, well, and with all respect to your guest, Elaine, she was absolutely marvelous. And but Queen of Bebop, I don't think so. I have
okay.
reservations. It's a great title, though. And thank you for what you're doing. She was exceptional. I will never forget her. I'm 92 years old, and I'll never forget her.
Well,
thank you for that wonderful memory.
What, to get a 70-year reminiscence from a guest on the radio is just so fabulous. Bob, thanks for your call. Dave Garraway gets a lot of play in the course of your book because he goes on to be a national star from his notoriety in Chicago, the first host of the Today Show, and a very early fan of Sarah Vaughan, which makes a difference.
Oh, yeah. He was an incredible advocate of hers, and he played her records all of the time. He was one of these independent, or he was one of these early DJs who's he was based in Chicago, but his influence, his broadcast went out through much of the Eastern Seaboard. And he really introduced audiences to her voice. And one of the things that's interesting about the way he talked about her, and he talked about her voice in a way that really belied racial categorization. Often DJs would kind of slip in little hints about, hey, yeah, you know, you're going to be listening to a vocalist that has a throaty, husky voice. And that was kind of code for a black singer. But he never did that with her. He really encouraged people to kind of close their eyes and open up their minds and just enjoy her beautiful voice. And that had a tremendous impact for her career.
When you run verbatim quotes of Dave Garraway, sometimes really over-the-top descriptions, are there still recordings of him working as a DJ? The evidence is there that he was totally transfixed by her work. But radio was so ephemeral, I was wondering how you found these quotes in the first place.
The Library of Congress. They have tapes of his early radio show in Chicago and several of them featuring Sarah Vaughan. So I was able to listen to those and really get a sense of how he was talking about music, how Sarah Vaughan was interacting with him. And, yeah, this language that he used is what he said. He would refer to her voice as, effervescent and shimmering and tiny gold sparks. It's just this very vivid way to talk about an amazingly beautiful voice.
John Keimel writes, "Hey, On Point Radio, you can still see the greatest American musicians cheap or free. Local music rocks." Talia writes, "I'm enjoying this segment about Sarah Vaughan. Nice break from the real world." And Edruslav writes, "Sarah Vaughan's history is amazing. A later album, Brazilian Romance with Milton Nascimento, is one of my favorite of all." And that's a reminder that she allowed herself the genre-crossing privilege, singing with Milton Nascimento, singing from Porgy and Bess, Gershwin tunes, singing sacred and traditional. This went on through the course of her career.
Yeah, she was always pushing herself to try something new and different, a new challenge, a new way to express herself. And when I talk to vocalists working now, they say that's one of the things that really inspired them about her, that she was never afraid to try something new and take a musical chance. And they kind of brought that back to their own singing and the way that they approach singing in turn.
In 1982, Sarah Vaughan performed with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and that recording was released on the 1982 album Gershwin Live. Here's "My Man's Gone Now" from the opera Porgy and Bess.
But old man sorrows marching all the way with me, telling me I'm old.
she lose her man?
Elaine Hayes, as Sarah Vaughan got older, there was something about her lower register, her alto singing, that became so powerful and supple and tremendous. I mean, she still had a great upper register, but boy, stuff like My Man's Gone Now, you can really hear it.
Yeah, this section is amazing right here. Yeah, unlike a lot of singers as they get older, their voice, they start losing their voice. But with Sarah Vaughan, it was exactly the opposite. Her range got even wider. It got lower, like you're saying, and it got more supple and more flexible. Her voice just got better with age, which is really unusual, but lucky for us because we had so many more years of wonderful music.
Elaine Hayes, a good opportunity to get Sarah Vaughan back in the conversation. Do you think people will be listening a little bit more to her now over the summer?
I certainly hope so. She's one of those voices that is just unforgettable, and so much can be found in it. It's so beautiful.
Elaine Hayes is the author and music historian. She's just written a big biography of jazz legend Sarah Vaughan, the Queen of Bebop, the musical lives of Sarah Vaughan. We have a playlist of some of the songs you heard this hour at our website, where you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I really want you to take a look at this book because it has wonderful, wonderful photographs. It'll augment your enjoyment of the music. What are you working on next, Elaine Hayes? Do you know, or are you just busy telling people about Sarah Vaughan?
I am busy telling people about Sarah Vaughan. I haven't figured out what's next yet.
How long did this take, this work?
I've been working on this for a long time. I started it as a graduate student probably in 1999, and then I took a big break and from 2004 to 2010, and I've been working on it for the last four or five years.
Well, Elaine Hayes joined us from Seattle, Washington. Great to have you with us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
We'll go out with one of the final recordings of Sarah Vaughan's career, the jazz standard Birdland, from Quincy Jones' 1989 album, Back on the Block. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.